This is WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord, streaming live at WNHNFM.org, and you are listening to State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty. We are in week three, I guess, the beginning of week three, as the state of New Hampshire and the entire country adapt to a very different way of life for many of us as we take part responsibly in the restrictions of this public health crisis.
Our stay-at-home edition of State House Watch.
That's right. And there's still plenty to talk about and plenty to report on, even though, as State House Watchers will know, the House and Senate have suspended their legislative activity now until May 4th. There is one exception to that, which we will mention, but we want to keep our readers and our listeners informed about the very important activity that state government is engaging in to help us all respond responsibly and effectively to this crisis.
All right. And speaking of our readers, we are still putting out our weekly State House Watch newsletter on Fridays, which goes to an email list of 1,000 or more people. If you are not subscribing to that and would like to receive it, please check out our website at afsc.org/NH and look for the subscribe button. AFSC is the American Friends Service Committee, where Maggie and I are the New Hampshire co-directors, although we really haven't seen much of our office in recent weeks.
Right. Arnie, you're stopping by periodically to pick up some mail?
Anybody wants to send us a check to keep projects like State House Watch going, or to support the Arnie Alpert Action Fund and keep the American Friends Service Committee vital and effective after I retire in June, they can certainly mail things to 4 Park Street, Suite 304, Concord, New Hampshire, 03301. They can go to our website at afsc.org/NH. And certainly, to keep supporting this important radio station, Maggie, I've been thinking lately, of course, about the important role that can be played by community radio during a time and period of crisis when access to information is so important and access to social and cultural connections. We are connected to each other spiritually, emotionally, physically, and in terms of public health, even if we are not in the same place. So WNHNLP is a great resource for us. And if you go to WNHNFM.org, you can find all sorts of great shows and podcasts. You can listen live, and you can donate to keep this station on the air as a vital resource to keep us connected to each other in such a important and dangerous time.
That's right. I paid some bills yesterday over the weekend and paid them all electronically. And it did feel like a bit of a safer way to do things. So we do encourage people to make online donations to the places that need them.
Great. Maggie, what is going on at the State House?
So let's mention that there's a special meeting of the Joint Fiscal Committee on April 10th, given that the U.S. Congress has acted now a third time, the creation of a third COVID-19 relief package. State government has to come together in order to create or ensure that the mechanisms are operating for the state to receive that money. So they will be meeting virtually, I think living into some new ways of being that hadn't previously been utilized for state government. There's always been a strong commitment to public presence, public participation, and now at all levels, municipal, school board, state level, people are exploring how do we honor that commitment to full transparency and public observation while being responsible in this public health context.
Great. And we're hoping to be able to talk more about that next week. We are hoping to get Senator Donna Soucy, the president of the Senate, to talk to us during the week if she has time, and we'll bring that to you next week. And that's certainly one of the things I would like to ask her about, is how we do go forward with virtual meetings, physical distancing, while maintaining adherence to the principle and realities of the state's traditions and laws regarding what we call the right to know.
Through the executive branch, a lot of action is being taken that affects all aspects of our lives. Yeah, executive Proclamation number 17. Do you want to say a little bit about what that is?
Last week, the governor issued he's got a whole series of these now. You mentioned 17. I think we're up to 19 now, and each one has some different specifics. But certainly the stay-at-home order is one of the weightier ones that really is saying stay at home. If you do not need to go out, you should not do so. And obviously there are reasons why people need to go out for medical appointments or to get groceries, but otherwise for reasons that are not essential, you should stay at home. Now, accompanying that order, there is another order which has a list of what is deemed to be essential. And that starts to get kind of interesting, Maggie, as he goes into this whole list of different categories. It's Exhibit A to Emergency Order Number 17, and you can look that up. If you go to nh.gov on the web, you can find the state's coronavirus special resource link, but you can also go to the governor's page where these are listed out, all of the executive orders. So they're in all these different areas, Maggie: law enforcement, public safety and first responders, food and agriculture, healthcare, public health, human services, energy, public works, communications, information technology, manufacturing. Anyway, it goes on and on and on. And it's a reasonable list. I actually was looking also at the list listed by the governor of Massachusetts, which had a lot of similar categories. So I'm sure that the emergency officials from the different states are in touch with each other. I've been curious about the extent to which they were already prepared for this type of emergency or whether they started from scratch to put this type of list together. But clearly they are well organized and thinking, I'd say, mostly clearly about this. Of course, one of the things that was difficult to escape notice was the governor listing gun-related businesses as being part of what are considered essential services right now. We're not the only state. There's a couple dozen states that have listed that on their list of essential services, but there are others, including the surrounding states of Maine, New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts, where guns are not considered essential. So I think that's an interesting little New Hampshire standout that I'm not all that impressed by. Our friend Arnie Arneson, who hosts The Attitude here on WNHN, tweeted the other day that she thought that maybe the people who are into guns already had all the guns they needed before. But I don't really know about that. I was glad to see that garden stores were listed as essential that could be remain open. I think that this is a time for a lot of people to be thinking about how can we produce more food and raise flowers to decorate our lives in a time that has a lot of grim things that are going on around us. Let's look for beauty and let's look for nourishment in new ways if we can. The governor is also insistent that we should go out and get fresh air and get exercise, although that needs to be done in ways that are socially responsible, and we need to be keeping our physical distance from others that we see out on the trail or out on the sidewalk or out in the woods.
There was some concern that despite the restriction with regard to beaches, that there were a large number of people still choosing to go to the beaches over the weekend. So I don't know if we'll see any kind of escalation in terms of consequence or enforcement of those, of that guidance and those restrictions, but people do love to get to the seacoast, and it is part of people's mental health, as you say, to, you know, appreciate nature. So we've got to figure out how to do that responsibly and honor the restrictions that are being put in place for our well-being. It seems that some of the determination of what is essential has more to do with mitigating some economic consequences of the public health response. I noticed that realtors were lobbied to be included and were approved. And I gather there's a process by which retailers can seek approval for being determined as essential. So
that is
a little bit fluid.
Yeah. Now, Maggie, I know that you are one of those many people who like to hike Mount Major, which has now been closed off to the public, but I understand you found another hiking trail over the weekend.
Yes, my daughter and I went fairly early in the morning to a beautiful little spot in Stratford and Farmington called Blue Job. And when we pulled in, we were the third or fourth car and had a lovely walk, encountering a couple of people, but certainly a great distance. But by the time we came out, the parking lot was overflowing and the cars were lining the streets. So I was saying to you that if I had pulled in and the parking lot looked that full, I would have opted not to go in. But we did have a lovely, quiet 90 minutes in the beautiful woods in this part of New Hampshire.
That's great. Well, where I live out in the woods in Canterbury near the Shaker Village, I don't really need to drive anywhere in order to get a beautiful walk. I had a lovely walk the other morning and ran into a father with his two children trying to figure out about beaver dams and beaver lodges. And it was lovely to see them, but it was also, Maggie, a little disturbing that I had to kind of back away from this small child as the small child walked toward me with a question, or we wanted to meet each other. And I had to not go toward the child. I had to go away. I knew this child wasn't going to understand, but I knew the father did. So it was still lovely to see them out there trying to figure out this emerging spring as it is budding forth around us, seeing the coltsfoot coming up, seeing the snowdrops, seeing crocuses, seeing the maple tree starting to bud out right now, seeing spring every year after a long New Hampshire winter is something that gives hope. And I think a lot of people are getting more hope from that this year than usual.
Yes, but you're naming the pain and the awkwardness of at a time when we really are seeking connection. The ways that we have to avoid certain kinds of connection are painful.
One way that I had some positive connection last week was I was on a Zoom call with a bunch of people from the public health sector. So these were people who worked for the state, worked for local health agencies, people who are healthcare providers, as well as people who are human service providers and people who are in touch with the needs of especially vulnerable populations in the state. This was convened by the New Hampshire Public Health Association. I thought it was a great thing for them to do. I was glad to be able to participate. I think that that will become a regular thing. It will be something that we can use to identify places where needs are not getting addressed, that need to be addressed to protect, again, to protect the health of particularly vulnerable people. But that really is a way of protecting everybody, that we are all tied together in ways that perhaps we were less aware of before this crisis developed. And now, even if we are physically distant, we know that the virus itself can travel in ways that ultimately put everybody in danger, no matter how distant we are.
That's right. And another thing I think that should heighten our awareness is the very meaningful, effective role that government can play in leading and supporting necessary responses to a crisis such as this at all levels, the municipal level, the state level, the federal level. Hopefully, and you know, we'll try to keep lifting this up for people. Hopefully we can help folks to recognize that government is an extremely important partner in creating an economy that works for people, in supporting a public health response that keeps people healthy and safe, and ensuring that all of the aspects of our society be adequately resourced and coordinated.
And of course, I think that's absolutely correct. And that's always in tension with potentials for governmental overreach and excessive use of governmental authority, which I would say our jail and prison system is probably the biggest and most ominous example of. And we're seeing that right now, that the jails and the prisons are the places where people are perhaps most at risk.
We have been at the American Friends Service Committee trying to send strong messages to elected officials that they must act in response to the heightened vulnerability of people in prisons, jails, and detention centers, including the Stratford County Jail in Dover, which, in addition to people serving criminal sentences and awaiting criminal hearings, is also housing many civilly detained immigrants for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And we want to see anyone who doesn't have to be in that facility to be responsibly released so that they are not exposed themselves or putting staff or other imprisoned people at risk. Never Again Action New Hampshire has a petition sending a message to Governor Sununu that he leverage his authority as the leader of New Hampshire's response to this crisis to call upon the Stratford County officials to demand that civilly detained immigrants be released. So multiple good actions nationally. This is Detention Watch Network, a national network of immigrant rights organizations. It is launching a week of action this week, sending messages to ICE and CBP to to free people from their custody.
And there is a letter to ICE and CBP, the Border Patrol, that is on our website at afsc.org/NH in the resources section if you'd like to see it. And again, Maggie, how do people find that Never Again petition? Do you know if they want to add their names?
Never Again Action NH on Facebook will take you straight to there.
That's a good thing to do. Speaking of the federal government, there is a major package that was finally got through the Senate and the House last week and was signed very quickly by President Trump. Could you say a word or two, Maggie, about what is in that and how it affects New Hampshire?
Sure. So there is help in this bill for individuals, for small businesses, for big businesses, for municipal governments, for states, for hospitals. It's a really a very holistic response, and nearly, as you say, $2 trillion. But I think what people might pay most attention to are the cash payments that will be coming our way for individuals earning less than $75,000, a one-time cash payment of $1,200, $500 per child. The benefits are eased off as people move up the income ladder. Another important development that took a lot of really good progressive advocacy was investments in unemployment payments states will continue to pay unemployment to those who qualify. This will extend that period of time by another 13 weeks, and it adds funds to the payments being made. There were some provisions for forgiveness of student loans, a benefit through employers. We were excited to see that gig workers and freelancers are included in unemployment benefits through something called the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. There's an extension on the deadline for filing your tax returns. There's a requirement that all private insurance plans cover COVID-19 treatments and the vaccine and makes all the tests free. It is not clear that the treatments would be free, but the testing is. And then in other sectors, they'll experience additional benefits. We were glad to see that for the billions, the hundreds of billions of dollars going to big businesses, however, that the president and the vice president and their children and in-law, sons-in-law, daughters-in-law will be prohibited from receiving any direct benefit from this.
How about that?
Yeah.
How about that? Well, certainly glad to see members of New Hampshire's congressional delegation pitching in support of putting this package together. Although I have to say, Maggie, that I was distressed a couple of weeks ago to see the names of Representatives Custer and Pappas calling for production of 19 additional F-35 warplanes beyond the large number that was already in the Pentagon's budget request. A great example of what President Eisenhower 60 years ago called the military-industrial complex. It still is at work. With our colleague Tori Bateman, I wrote a little column about that, which you can find at afsc.org in the blog section. And we sort of wonder where our protection of our public health, where our safety, where our defense actually comes from. Wouldn't we be better off spending on N95s than on F-35s right now? Check that out. So we're going to play a little song now. It's an old song, but it's a sentiment in this time of physical distancing that is as current as possible. When we come back, we'll have an interview that Maggie conducted with Alyssa Marglin from Housing Action New Hampshire. And later on, we'll have a conversation with Ava Castillo from the New Hampshire Alliance for Immigrants and Refugees. You are listening to State House Watch on WNHN-LP.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was sick. again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
You are listening to State House Watch Radio on 94.7 FM WNHN in Concord. This is Maggie Fogarty from the American Friends Service Committee, and I'm with Alyssa Margolin from Housing Action New Hampshire. Welcome, Alyssa.
Hi, Maggie. Good to be with you.
You've been a guest on our radio show before, but it would be great if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Housing Action and its important work.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I serve as director of Housing Action New Hampshire. We're a statewide coalition of 80 organizations united around affordable housing policy and ending homelessness in New Hampshire. We work to improve state and federal policy with the hopes that everyone in New Hampshire will have a place to call home.
And certainly in the midst of this coronavirus crisis, this public health urgent period of time that we're in, we are thinking about different groups of vulnerable people and how care and safety can be extended to them so that our whole community is safe and so that no one's left out of the solutions and the responses that are being generated. What are your particular concerns? What are you hearing from Housing Action members about the needs of homeless people and precariously housed people in New Hampshire?
Thanks. That's such a good question. For the last 2 weeks, we've been in constant contact with our homeless service providers. We've been hearing from our policymakers, isolate, stay at home, stay 6 feet away from one another. But if you live in a homeless shelter, that is impossible to practice.
Mm-hmm.
There are no safe places to quarantine within a homeless shelter. So that has been a big focus of ours to raise that awareness with the leaders who are establishing emergency procedures for us during this time.
I imagine it's also a concern how to reach people whose home is a tent, whose lack of secure housing has them moving around, perhaps camping, perhaps moving from couch to couch. Are you hearing from homeless outreach workers as well?
We are. The reality is there are encampments around our state, and the counsel we're getting from our leaders who work with this vulnerable population is to urge law enforcement to implement no sweep policies during this time. And that simply means not going into encampments and encouraging folks to leave. They have established community there. Their folks may differ as to what they think on whether or not that is just or fair or healthy for community. But in this case, the right thing to do is to improve those encampment sites. So to provide porta potties and portable showers on site, and as well as, you know, other forms of hand sanitizer and some personal protective equipment if need be, and to improve those tent sites by providing clean tents, new sleeping bags, and ground mats.
You know, just thinking about, too, the added exposure that people have, we know that homelessness and the stress of economic insecurity create health conditions that put homeless people and poor people into a vulnerable group, even apart from their housing, right? The health conditions that people live with, the fact that many people who are experiencing a housing crisis are older. So for multiple layers of identity and characteristics of people, then, you know, you're really dealing with a very heightened set of risks.
Yeah, I mean, among the residents of New Hampshire who are experiencing homelessness, there are many who are medically frail, and not all too. I mean, some folks can find themselves in a shelter and not have, you know, troubling
other health concerns.
But there are, you know, there just definitely are among that population consistently a significant percentage of them who have other health conditions. And sometimes co-occurring disorders like, you know, substance use disorder with some mental health issues as well.
Right. So a complex set of conditions. We might have time during this interview to also talk about the vulnerability of people who are losing their jobs. And April 1 is this week. I imagine people are quite worried about paying all of the bills, including rent. And I know some actions have been taken with regard to protection from eviction. So let's shift and talk about what you, as a leading advocate in the state, have been hoping for as part of the state's response to this crisis, and what you're seeing take shape, because I understand that there's been some very good developments.
There has. So for the last 2 weeks, Housing Action New Hampshire and our members have been calling for a statewide response for temporary shelter solutions for the homeless population. There are 46 homeless shelters throughout our state, and they simply don't have the space they need, the staff they need, the supplies they need to address this crisis. And I'm really pleased that at the end of last week, the Emergency Operations Center brought in someone, Tori Jennison from the Region 6 Integrated Delivery Network, who has a really strong background in public health. She's a nurse, and she's also had experience working with shelters and the homeless population. And she was brought in early Friday morning, and by 4 o'clock that afternoon, we saw a statewide plan taking shape. And I'm almost ready to breathe a sigh of relief, but not quite. But my understanding is that they were working nonstop over the weekend to plug a statewide temporary shelter plan into the broader surge work that's happening around the state, both in terms of providing expanded healthcare facilities and space for first responders and other vulnerable populations. And so I'm this morning getting a briefing on where we are with that. I know that two of our largest shelters in the state, Crossroads House in Portsmouth and Families in Transition New Horizons in Manchester, were able to speak with Tori Jennison on Friday and really felt like we were headed towards something that they could work with. And so for me, makes me feel like we now have some real leadership there. I heard from Deputy Commissioner Perry Plummer that they were bringing some real attention to this issue on Friday morning. So, you know, hopefully this week we can avoid the catastrophe that we thought we might be facing. And have some real solutions. I'm super grateful too to, you know, the governor's office and Deputy Commissioner Plummer at Department of Safety, and to this rock star, Tori Jennison, for stepping into this role.
That's terrific. And so it's investments in equipment and building space, or is it additional personnel? Is it just give me some idea of what's the shape of the assistance that's coming?
So obviously the real hope is when we get the details, and I don't have those details yet. I do know that there's a real understanding that many people experiencing homelessness don't have a primary care physician. So telling that resident, you know, you need to call your PCP is not going to work, so that they're being plugged into resources like healthcare for the homeless. And there's a lot of collaboration going on. I do know that the Department of Health and Human Services was working on repurposing some transportation contracts. So transportation contracts for programs that are not currently underway because of the stay-at-home order and other programs that are not happening, and repurposing them so that they could transport and decongregate, is that a word? Shelters so that to kind of thin out the population and create more space to keep people healthy. And so I really heard a lot of really thoughtful details, both about clinical screens, transportation, identification of sites, and on-site services, and virtual casework. So having direct care and caseworkers be able to connect with their clients virtually, to check in daily with them to see how they're doing. And this is stressful on anyone. If you have issues with anxiety and mental health issues, and if you're not able to access your medication and you're losing your community and your friends, this is extremely stressful. So we're going to have to make sure that as we, you know, move people around, that we're taking care of them at the same time. And I really felt like what I heard was a really good understanding of the need to continue to provide those services. I hope to get more details today, but I'm feeling hopeful.
Wonderful. And, you know, you and I were talking briefly before the interview about how there are some silver linings in all of this. And I think one of them is a reminder that when leadership comes together to listen well to the crisis in communities and to the voices of people who are affected by a crisis and by the ways that our system needs to, you know, has maybe failed to respond in the past, that we have great capacity to create plans and direct resources. And it's quite possible that in multiple sectors, we come out of this crisis with deeper wisdom and greater faith in the work of government to respond, in government in partnership with leaders from communities to respond to unmet needs. Where will the plan, particularly for homeless services during this coronavirus, where will it be posted that people can read the details later today or tomorrow?
So I have a briefing coming up in a couple of hours, and that's exactly my hope, is that we can find that link that we're all looking for that has the plan. And there are actually daily briefings going on between the Department of Health and Human Services and the shelter community. You know, DHHS was there early with them. I don't want to say that, you know, we had to wait this last moment for some real leadership. That, you know, DHHS and public health were meeting with shelters very early on about about screening folks who come in and about, you know, on-site preventative measures. But we really, that's where we are now. We have some leadership, and we have to be able to provide, communicate that statewide plan to everyone. So I think we can expect to see that hopefully today or in the next couple of days.
Wonderful. And we'll link to that in our newsletter on Friday as well. So you are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio on WNHN 94.7 FM in Concord. I'm Maggie Fogarty with the American Friends Service Committee, and I am talking with the Director of Housing Action New Hampshire, Alyssa Margolin. Alyssa, with the few minutes that we have left, can you talk a little bit about what's happening at the federal level with regard to a housing and homeless response? And in particular, I believe there were resources in the recently congressionally approved COVID response package. What's in there?
Yes, with some great advocacy from our federal partner, the National Low Income Housing Coalition, there were major investments in HUD programs in the last Corona relief package. And those include additional resources for homeless services. They include more vouchers, both those kind of tenant-based vouchers where tenants can take out on the market, and project-based vouchers to attach to more units to provide that relief of for high rents. There's also more capital, finally, for our public housing agencies. Really been struggling with that.
For a long time, right? Those have been needed.
It's good to see a recognition that they're being also, you know, very responsive to this and need a lot of flexibility from HUD right now, because they're highly regulated agencies and they need some flexibility right now. So that, you know, I think the package overall is really good for housing. If there's a round four, I think you'll see us being more vocal about USDA rural housing, because it's actually for our state, you know, generally about $200,000 per year comes in from HUD. $200 million a year comes into New Hampshire from HUD, and $200 million comes in also from USDARD. Most of that is rental assistance, but it's just as important. And so USDA rural development was left out of the housing equation this last round, but hopefully could be included in another relief package.
And do you know if the rental assistance vouchers, et cetera, are time limited, or is it simply put forward as an expanded pool of resources for those tools?
I don't know. I mean, and I don't know the details yet on state allocations and how, if the states will have more flexibility in implementing them during this crisis. I mean, one would hope for that flexibility right now. There's a lot, as you noted, you know, this crisis brings up the important role of government, the important role of community, how we are connected and need each other, how we all have the importance of your cashier at Market Basket and the importance of the person in the warehouse. But it also brings up this idea of there is the light also on the complexities of bureaucracy when we need to act. I wonder if that will have some sustainability, or if we'll kind of go back into kind of hyper-regulation mode that policymakers tend to want to do for reasons about, you know, directing resources and accountability of taxpayer funds and mostly good intentions, but sometimes can really hamper us to take action.
Right, and can prevent programs from talking to each other so that assistance can be patched together for people in need. Just briefly, I don't want to neglect what I understand is work that's been done both at the state level and at the federal level to prevent evictions and foreclosures during this time. Can you just give us a working understanding of what's going to be available to people and how?
Yes, I'm glad we'll close with this. So New Hampshire was really early with some great leadership from New Hampshire Legal Assistance calling on a statewide moratorium for eviction and foreclosure, also a moratorium on public utility shutoffs. And now we have that national policy in place as well. And that is good and it's important as we deal with this crisis. But I will say that we need to be looking forward 3 or 4 months and the crisis we're going to face then, because half of our renter population was already rent burdened in New Hampshire, meaning, and I think our median rent is close to $1,400 a month. So if you're struggling, you were struggling then to pay your $1,400 a month rent, and you had signed a lease for 12 months, and there's a high probability now that you lost your job and you're on unemployment earning less. In 3 or 4 months' time, we're going to have an evictions crisis and a homeless surge if we are not taking action. So we'll have to work to make sure that we have an eviction prevention fund in place and a process, because it really, preventing eviction is the one of the best tools to ending homelessness. And so we'll need to collectively work on that.
So the work will certainly continue. Well, Alyssa Martelin, thank you so much for your advocacy, for communicating the progress that's being made so that people can take full advantage of the resources and the policy changes that are being made to keep our communities, to help our communities, and to keep us healthy and strong. So I appreciate you very much, and I appreciate you making time for this conversation in the midst of it all.
Thank you, and thank you for all of your work.
That was Maggie Fogarty talking with Alyssa Margolin from Housing Action New Hampshire. And this is Billy Bragg, waiting for the great leap forward.
It might have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies a rich lady who's crying over luxury's disappointment, so he walks over and he's trying to sympathize with her. But he thinks that he should warn her that the third world is just around the corner. In the Soviet Union, a scientist is blinded by the resumption of nuclear testing, and he is reminded that Dr. Robert Oppenheimer's optimism fell at the first hurdle. In the cheese pavilion, and the only noise I hear is the sound of someone stacking chairs and mopping up spilled beer, and someone asking questions and basking in the light of the 15 fame-filled minutes of the fanzine writer. Mixing pop and politics, he asks me what the use is. I offer him embarrassment and my usual excuses, while looking down the corridor out to where the van is waiting. I'm looking for the great leap forward. Jumble sales are organized, pamphlets have been posted. Even after closing time, there's still parties to be hosted. You can be active with the activists or sleeping with the sleepers while you're waiting for the great leap forwards. Oh, one leap forwards, two leaps back. Will politics get me the sack? Waiting for the great leap. Blacklist, I wanna be on it, waiting for the right leap forward. Well, it's a mighty long way down rock and roll from top of the pops to drawing a down. You're waiting for the right leap forward. If no one out there understands, just start your own revolution and cut out the middle man. For the right leap forward. Perfect world, we're all singing tune, but this is reality, skip some room. Waiting for the right leap forward. So join the struggle while you make the revolution, it's just a t-shirt away. Waiting
for the right leap forward. Waiting for the right leap forward. Waiting for the right leap forward. Waiting for the right leap forward.
Bring it up, Scotty!
Waiting for the right leap forward. Waiting for the right leap forward.
That was Billy Bragg, and this is Statehouse Watch, where the revolution is only a Zoom call away. Ava Castillo, welcome to Statehouse Watch.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Ava, I've always thought of you as kind of the one of the go-to people in Manchester in the Latino community. I mean, for decades now, when people have been having emergencies or crises, whether it's with their employer, whether it's their landlord, whether it's about healthcare, whether it's with the police, they call you. I'm wondering, when did you start to realize that something was going on with coronavirus and the calls and contacts you were having with people in the community started to shift?
I think the community itself became more aware about 3 weeks ago when they started telling people, encouraging people to stay home and all of that. Before that, I don't think people were taking it too seriously or there was not much information. And you know, it's hard to seek information when you're worried about putting food in your table. So people don't really have much time to pay attention to that. But about 3 weeks ago, when they started encouraging people to stay home and some restaurants and places started telling their workers not to go to work, that's when it started really hitting people that we're in a real crisis here.
Are you hearing different things from people in particular who are undocumented?
Yeah, people, first, a lot of undocumented people work in places where they have really turned a blind eye to them in that they don't ask, like don't ask, don't tell sort of thing. So now they're worried about how is this. I've got a couple calls where my employer has no clue whether I have papers or not. And if I don't call unemployment, are they going to find out and come after me because I didn't file unemployment? I know I don't qualify for it. So how is this going to affect? So in addition to the fact that they're not, that they have lost their income and they get no, they really have no help, people are concerned that this is going to make it, you know, public that they do not have papers.
So, I mean, some people are working formally. I mean, people are getting paychecks and such, and some people are working totally under the table. Is there a difference in terms of what kind of access to services such as unemployment people might be eligible for as a result of that?
Well, the people that have no papers have no access whatsoever to any type of safety net. And these people I talk just about, they are people that work, you know, with a tax ID number. And if you have a tax ID number, you have the duty to pay taxes for all the wages that you have no right to earn. But these people, the fact is they don't have papers and they do not, they are out of this, the unemployment, they're out of the stimulus. They're not going to get the stimulus package. Those that have work permits can do it. But, you know, the majority of the undocumented people here are not going to, they don't qualify for any type of benefit, subsidized housing. They don't qualify for food stamps. They don't qualify for the stimulus money that the president just approved. They don't qualify for unemployment, for anything.
So some people will probably find ways to continue working under the table, perhaps at risk to themselves and their families and to the broader community. I'm curious, Ava, if you're starting to see relief funds popping up or places where people are going to be able to go for emergency assistance to simply be able to put food on the table?
Well, I know the churches have their pantries and they have always been very open for the food pantries. There's some funding going on in Massachusetts. In New Hampshire, I have yet to see, but this morning, as I was dreaming last night, I said, okay, maybe I should approach a couple of the big action funds of churches in New Hampshire and see if they'd be willing to sponsor something like that. Yesterday, I got a call by a landlord that has 4 undocumented families in 4 of his apartments saying, would you start one? But, you know, that handling money, I don't want to be responsible for handling money as an individual. There's a lot of complexities. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people trying to scam money under the guise of helping. So I want to go through some type of fund already, something that is already has a foundation of doing that and see if they'd be willing to start something, because a lot of these people are going to need help to pay their rent and to, you know, even if they said, no, you cannot evict people, the fact is that you're still going to all that money.
Right. That's right. When this crisis is over and the ban on evictions is lifted, people are going to find themselves owing back rent.
That's right. Back rent, and they're in the hole and they start working and they're still going to take some time before they can even pay the current month. So it's not going to be easy.
These schools are closed. So a lot of the students obviously are at home and they're supposed to be continuing to be studying and learning and taking classes and in touch with their teachers. What are you hearing about people in Manchester in terms of how that is being experienced?
Well, you know, a lot of the people have no access to internet. They have no access. And for limited English proficient people, I wonder how they're going to help their children or people that have no very low education themselves. I have been trying to even help my grandkid, my granddaughter with her math, and the way they do math now makes no sense whatsoever. And I don't understand. I know how to do the operations, but it's the old way. And if you do not show your process the way they like it, even if the result is correct, they don't take it as a right answer. So I wonder if this happens to me, that, you know, I have 15 years of college in this country, what happens to a person that doesn't speak the language and that has very little education?
Yeah. So that's certainly one of my fears, is that the disparities in our educational system that we've been aware of all along are going to get exaggerated during this crisis. I'm hopeful that at least we'll learn something from it, so that when we get back to a new normal, hopefully we flatten the curve and all this other stuff happens, that we're able to learn some lessons that can create changes and fixes for the long term. Ava, relatively early on into this crisis, there was a welcome announcement from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that they were going to stop the types of raids that they've done and that they were going to go back to what we might think of as an Obama-era enforcement policy of focusing only on arresting and trying to deport people who were accused of serious crimes. I'm curious if you have actually seen the impact of that and if people understand that change.
People don't trust anything coming from ICE. And so they're still in fear. I have not heard in the past couple weeks of anybody being picked up. But, you know, even during the Obama era, yes, they were supposed to be targeting dangerous criminals, but they still, if you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, even if all you had was the lack of a piece of paper saying that you're a permanent resident, you were a danger. So this is not going to stop deportations, I don't think.
That's a realistic assessment, I'm sure, of what's going on. We have also heard that ICE has told people who were supposed to be checking in with them at their office in Manchester that they can now do that by phone, which I assume is at least safer for everybody, including the ICE officers. And we'll see how long that goes. And I'm sure we'll learn more as this does go along about whether or not those phone check-ins are taking place or whether people are getting any type of greater, what we might call, harassment from the officials as this goes on.
And how long the space between one check-in and the other goes, because you never know if they're going to go back to checking every month or checking every 6 months. Who knows what they're going to be doing now.
Ava, for people who are Spanish speakers and Spanish listeners and don't have fluency in English, where are they getting their news about what's going on right now and what to do? Do you think people are getting an accurate assessment, or are people more trapped in the rumor mill than the rest of us?
Well, people get the news really from the TV, the Spanish news in Miami or whatever, or they just go word of mouth. So there's a lot of stuff floating around that might not be correct. Last week, I was talking to the head of the multicultural, I don't know her exact name, about access to that. And we're trying to figure out how to make sure that first is whatever information is vetted by them, and then where to place that information so at least people have access to it. But it's been very difficult to disseminate, because we do not have a place where everybody congregates. And before was the churches, but now the churches are not having services, and that still did not reach out the majority of people, but at least it was a place. So we really do not have a good method, and there are no media that cater to the Latino community in Spanish or written or TV or anything.
Nothing local. That is unfortunate. And that's really kind of a function of what's happened overall to the mass media in this country. It's easier, right, for people to probably get the news from Mexico or from Peru than it is to find out what's actually going on in our own community in their own language. So that's an interesting thing. Ava, as the curve flattens, we hope, and as the pandemic passes and we get to the other side, what are some of the things that you're hoping right now that we will learn from this?
Well, I hope that we learn that we're all in this together. This is a great equalizer. It's hitting everybody in the same place, in the same way. You know, it's not only people of color, it's not only the people that are undocumented, it's not that. So I hope that we embrace our humanity and that we learn that we're all equal, regardless of all the exterior circumstances, if anything, you know. And it, so in a way, that has been a way of having people realize their own humanity and how we're really linked to one another, whether we like it or not.
That's right. Dr. King says we are trapped in an inescapable garment of mutuality. What affects one of us affects all of us. So I think that's your message too. Ava Castillo, thank you so much for being with us on State House Watch, and good luck to you and your family and to all the lives that you touch.
Thank you, and thank you for all you do.
That was Arnie Alpert talking with Ava Castillo, director of the New Hampshire Alliance for Immigrants and Refugees.
This is State House Watch on WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord, streaming live at WNHNFM.org. Maggie Fogarty, what have we got coming up that our listeners might be interested in?
Let me say that there are plenty of advocacy opportunities from the comfort of your home. While we often find ourselves encouraging people into public spaces and into actions where we are physically with each other, building community, now is a time to take the actions that we can take from our restricted spaces. So look for that Never Again Action New Hampshire petition calling upon Governor Sununu to raise his voice to release people from detention at the Stafford County Jail. Look for the AFSC petition to Governor Sununu and to ICE insisting that there be no immigration enforcement or detention of immigrants during this pandemic. But then there are several events that would have happened in person that have been moved online. And one coming up this week on Thursday, April 2nd, is sponsored by Open Democracy. It's an event with Olivia Zink, Isaac Grimm, Louise Spencer, and Arnie Alpert called What Every Organizer Must Know to Build Power and Move Members to Action. So that's 7 to 8:15 p.m. on Zoom. And you can contact Olivia Zink or go to the Open Democracy website to RSVP and get the link.
We'll be back next week with another episode of State House Watch. Thanks for listening.
Going down the road, meeting a man. Going down the road, meeting a man. Going down the road, meeting a man. Don't want to be treated this way. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Don't want to be treated this way. Going down the road, feeling bad.
water tastes like wine. Oh, and where the water tastes like wine.